I love scotch. 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 Scotch.
Yep. Have another whiskey.
If you'd like to speak to me in person, press 1. If you'd like to order drugs, press hash.
I had a gentleman in the crowd that was like, tell me how to drink Glenfiddich. And I was like, I will not do that.
Yep.
You drink Glenfiddich how you want to drink Glenfiddich.
Wear a cowboy hat in Los Angeles and look at the amount of looks you get.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. This is the most flamboyant city on earth. You wear a cowboy hat, people look at you like you are like an alien.
The Beatles came on and my mate picked me up on his shoulder. George Harrison is as close to me as that wall now. I went, all right, George, all right. And he went, cock. And that was the closest I ever came to the Beatles.
We have a whiskey while we...
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Cheers,
cheers,
long.
Cheers. So welcome back to United States of Dramerica. We have on here not just any immigration lawyer, but the immigration lawyer without whom I wouldn't be able to live in America because she helped me get my visa. So welcome to the podcast and thank you again for that, Lorraine D'Alessio.
Hi, hi. Thank you so very much for having me today. It's such a joy to be here with you.
So obviously, we might as well jump straight into this because a combination of the last 4 years or nearly 4 years now of constantly changing immigration policy and changing of the rules around immigration policy, coupled with 8 months of a global pandemic and the combination of difficulties around travel, but also difficulties around the people who process visas getting into their offices. This must have been the most complicated period you've ever faced in your career.
It certainly has. It's been very challenging. It's all about understanding what is working and not necessarily what may be written down places and what supervisors are where, whether that's at the consulate level or whether that is, with USCIS and, internally in the US. So the processing of, petitions has been, subject to a lot of changes recently. That's for sure. So we've certainly been on the edge of our seats as we've heard, all these proclamations coming down as well. And now with a new administration coming in and, the effect that will have. So,
because when we did my green card, which was a couple of years ago now, obviously the Trump administration was in, but I think some of the rule changes hadn't really started to come in yet. And yet that process still, I'm trying to think exactly how long it took from, beginning to prepare the applicant through to actually physically getting my green card through the door. I feel like it was the best part of a couple of years from start to finish. Now, I had a complicated case because I was leaving the diplomatic service, but what's the average length of time from first call with you to receiving cards now?
Well, right now it's definitely been about a year to a year and a half, and sometimes stretching to that 2 year mark. Also depending on whether people are, opting to do a premium process for the I-140, which is still available, which is often that first step you're going to take in processing the petition and looking at the first set of criteria there, an assessment onto the ground of the merits of the case to be assessed by USCIS. So if you're, if you can, expedite that petition and you don't get follow-up questions on the case, then it can go much faster. Indeed, what we experienced, even in around the time that you went through this is something called retrogression, which is essentially a backlog with the green cards. And when it comes to often that second portion of the filing or the adjustment can occur around the I-485 if you're doing it internally in the US. And also for interviews if you're going from abroad at the consular level. So I would say a year to a year and a half to 2 years, in that ballpark there. And indeed, we haven't noticed it to be any faster than that. So
no, I'm sure. Is now the hardest time in your career that you can remember to get into America?
I would say yes, but in fact, you know, just before COVID hit, you know, even with, you know, under this administration, indeed, we noticed it was quite difficult at the for extraordinary ability petitions, which is the O-1 visa or the P visa, and that would be for individuals of extraordinary ability or for groups that are coming in. We noticed a real upkick in the number of follow-up questions on cases and, you know, frequency of denials. And, you know, there's not supposed to be a quota system at all with extraordinary ability. However, many of us, you know, that file enough of these petitions question whether there might be one, but one that they weren't stating that is out there, you know, just because, you know, one petition would go through, you know, so smoothly, another same, very similar set of facts, you know, similar evidence being put forward, and yet one would have difficulty, the other one wouldn't. So it's, you know, so that's thought of, you know, a bit of a challenge then. So, and, you know, under Obama, you know, many point out in the immigration community, and I think they are right to do that, that we actually had the most deportations of any president under Obama. So, you know, we're more business immigration, but when it comes to many, many communities, you know, of those that are the undocumented communities that are obviously seeking immigration reliefs, had a very tough time under Obama.
So obviously there are politicians who say things about immigration, and then there are thousands of people who actually work in the offices who presumably are, some of them are apolitical. Did it seem to you that the things people were saying at the top weren't always translating into the actual things on the ground, for better or for worse?
Absolutely. I would say that, yes. You know, it was, you know, a heralding of merits-based immigration, you know, with Trump and you know, this really seemed to be the course. And we will also, you know, there was a lot of commentary around investor visas and foreigners that are going to be bringing investment into the U.S. and we need to, you know, protect those. And in fact, the experience is, you know, extraordinary ability. Certainly, we felt that there was a strict standard that was put there, much stricter. And we also noticed that the investor routes, certainly at the consulate level, became very challenging. So almost a hidden speak there. And I would say that what we have heard from our meetings, you know, among immigration lawyers, you know, we're part of an association, and there's committees within that and chapters within that. And in these, you know, briefings that we've had, we've definitely noted that there has been documented and, you know, described to be a general fear among the lower level officers when it comes to that supervisor. And if they put in place a certain policy that, you know, supporting a Buy American, Hire American Trump policy, that if they went, you know, deviated from that at all in, you know, extending a certain compassion for a petition or whatnot, that they were at risk of losing their job and would be fired. So that feeling, that spirit there is, I think, you know, certainly, you know, had an influence for us during these years. So,
yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. Now, talking specifically around COVID, so obviously, airlines aren't flying certain routes, people aren't allowed to go certain places, but there are still people who were halfway through their process or, you know, are wanting to change countries for all the reasons that people ever wanted to. So what's happening now? Is everything just going onto a big pile that's not being processed because people can't physically come in or out? What's really happening now with it all?
Well, there is an experience of slowdowns when it comes to people that are outside, and that has those that are inside the United States and can stay in the United States during this period are in a better position. If you're outside, we are noticing that the backlogs and the wait times and the queues getting quite longer for those that are trying to get in for their embassy for their consular appointments and to get their essentially their visas into their passport. passports. So they may have an I-797 approval notice. For example, if they're going for a non-immigrant petition like an O-1 or, you know, or, you know, H-1B, for example. And this has been driven by the proclamation, of course, Trump proclamations that came out that, you know, were really suspended as of March 20th, routine visa services at all U.S. embassy and consular posts were suspended as of March 20th. And we have seen, you know, reopenings. However, then we were hit again with another proclamation, basically temporarily blocking the issuance of green cards to foreign nationals outside of the United States. And then, you know, again, on June 22nd, additional visa categories being restricted, H-1B, H-2B, L-1, J-1. I mean, we're talking about visas that have been a cornerstone of business immigration for countless number of years, and now being subject to a complete ban, basically, on coming in, just shocked the whole immigration community. And of course, that produces the backlog there and more wait time there. We did see that a federal judge was able to rule a preliminary injunction against that latest proclamation, and, you know, basically saying that the president doesn't possess the powers of a monarch, cast aside immigration laws and you know, bypass Congress. Thank goodness that has now been lifted. But we had a freeze, and there were no such petitions that would be willing to go through at the consulate level. So you might have been, for example, a beneficiary of the H-1B lottery that came out. So yay, I got the lottery, I made it, this is wonderful. I have my approval. Okay, now I'm in the process of getting my appointment, and I've waited, and even it's COVID, and I've still been so patient. And you're cut off. We have a proclamation. You can't come. And so, and I mean, you could have a job on the line, and the employer look at that, and maybe the employer will be patient, and maybe the employer will not. Mm. And perhaps they will have another candidate that they had looked at, maybe number, you know, 30 of the list of 40 they had, and said, okay, we're going to go for this other person. So I think that there's been a lot of, you know, sort of surprises and shocks that we've had over this past, you know, 8 months, of course, 8-9 months now. But I will say that there is a light at the end of the tunnel here. I know we're dealing with COVID. However, come, you know, January 20th, we will start to see a repealing of all these very, very inhibiting, want to dare to even say draconian, you know, immigration policies place and proclamations even, and all kinds of stuff that we've seen under the Trump administration, and as well as a changeover in the staffings as well, so that we're able to really help to support the Biden administration. And I think one of the greatest hopes that we can say that we've seen is that Alejandro Mayorkas has now become U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security. Mm. It was one of the very first nominations to be made by Joe Biden, and this is a wonderful. Alejandro Mayorkas is the one that was really pushing and behind the whole DACA Dreamers acts to let, you know, children that were undocumented, you know, have some relief and be able to get work authorization in the U.S. And, you know, now that they, you know, are older, and most of them, you know, under the age of 30, able to come in and work now. So we see a more pro-immigration coming in now with Biden, and we just need to be very, very patient. It's not going to be quick, unfortunately. It will take many months to see this come to fruition. So, but there is a light. There is a light.
Yeah, obviously, he, you know, he is an immigrant himself. You know, that tells a story in itself. So interestingly, I left the government 2 years ago, but lots of people I know still don't really understand immigration stuff and don't know how it works. So they still call me up and say, well, you know, how do I get this visa and how I can do this and that? And as you know, I sometimes send them your way because you know a little bit more about this stuff than I do. I've heard some horror stories from people who've contacted me actually during the COVID period, saying they're in the UK, they're trying to get back, they just need to get a stamp from the embassy, but it's a year to get an appointment at the US embassy in London. Presumably these anecdotal stories are something you're hearing and seeing as well.
Yes, every day, all day long. So Oh, goodness. So we saw national interest exemptions come out, which basically gives one about a 30-day window to enter the U.S. If you have an approved working visa, would be the scenario typically, and you're making an application to say, hi, I have to be exempt from, you know, any restriction to enter. I have such economic urgency in my application. There will be American jobs put at risk. You need real numbers behind that. So this is going toward to your offer letter that you have in the petition. And, you know, at first, you know, they were getting approved. It was wonderful. We saw this before during 9/11, that the national interest exemption had come out at that time. And so we saw it now coming back again during this COVID time and this past administration. And then basically we saw a flash of wonderful approvals coming in and then just almost a screeching halt. Mm-hmm. We have not, there are, not to say that they're not going through at all. It's just to say that there have been enormous resistance, I would say. And we've had some wonderful successes. We have had others that we'd say, okay, we're going to have to wait and see and do this a bit later. Now, that can be heart-wrenching, of course. Even, you know, you've got your economic reasons to come in, but you may also be separated from family. And so that could be, you know, a big issue. So I think that, you know, you have to look at the facts of every case. And it's very important in terms of being able to help people to hear their narrative. And that's why you just want to think of your lawyer and your legal team in this time as being a partner on your team. And good lawyers will really hear you out and get the facts going of exactly, you know, all the circumstances that we have and what we can put forward. We've had wonderful successes through Dubai with third party nationals coming through. We've had successes through Monterrey, Mexico.
Yeah, because I mean, I know all sorts of stories. So when you're here and you're applying and you can't leave, or you have to get an exemption to leave, but you can only have one. So somebody will use it to go to a work conference and then they'll miss a family funeral because they can't get out again. And obviously the other way, people are stuck in the UK and can't get back into things. I mean, I have people, because normally they only call me when they're desperate. Presumably you have people in tears on the other end of the phone.
It's horrendous. Yeah, absolutely. It's heart-wrenching. I don't think I've worked so hard, like I think in perhaps my entire life. I think immigration attorneys that are really trying to advocate for their clients right now are pulling hours that are not to be believed. There's very little sleep happening because you're hearing these stories. And, you know, I mean, why do we do immigration? Why would an immigrant myself want to do immigration? It's because I would like to help others that are similarly situated. I've been through it before. I know the stakes. They're extremely high. You want to be there for them and you want to be successful always. Under this past administration, very difficult to find the exceptions and compassion. And, you know, and so it takes, again, thinking outside the box, different approaches to be able to really get that, you know, get through basically and get the result. And you got to be results driven and quite strategic. So, and try again. You know, I think not giving up is really important and not getting discouraged and not taking it personally. A lot of people, unfortunately, I've noticed take it personally. Oh, well, I'm maybe just not good enough or something like that. Actually, unless the attorney has told you that there is some serious flaws with your case in terms of eligibility, no. So that's something that should be discussing in quite length.
Yeah. Well, look, obviously, I'm grateful for what you did for me and my family. And I know there are other people who I've put onto you who are equally grateful. Look, there's enough heartbreak for now. Let's have a whiskey. So what are you drinking at your end, Lorraine?
Thank you. I'm having Johnny Walker Black Label, distilled, blended, and bottled in Scotland. There we go. Well, I hope that's okay.
That's perfect. Johnny Walker Black is a great drink to work on. I was trying to think of a suitable whiskey, and I picked one which is sort of half British, half American, which seemed appropriate. So I've got one called a fistful of bourbon.
Oh,
it's a bourbon bourbon style, but it's done by Glenfiddich in Scotland. So it's a mix of the two. So I'm going to pour myself a small one.
I was there with you to take a sip.
No, indeed. I'm trying to think. One of the last times we saw each other was having lunch at the Magic Castle, which I think is, I took you there to thank you for helping me with everything. It feels like a long time ago now. So let's do a bit of your story. So you are obviously now running an international law firm with offices in three countries.
Yes. So Asia, we have an office in Asia and Malaysia, and then another in Hong Kong, and we have Toronto and London, of course, as well. So, and obviously our headquarters is in Los Angeles, it's a lot to, I think it's important to have that global presence, and especially in doing this type of law, because in some ways I want to account myself now under this platform administration as being a glorified travel agent potentially, because there's many different ways now to get from A to B. It's now become A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So you gotta be willing to go through a number of routes to be able to get there. So I think that having that, having a team that is international is quite important. And yeah, so, but our headquarters is in LA, and spend a lot of time in LA, Europe, and in, of course, Asia. I'm used to going back and forth every month and a half to 2 months. And so it's a little bit odd not to be traveling, actually. Mm-hmm. So, but what can you do?
Indeed. So, look, you're an award-winning lawyer. You've got offices in five countries. So let's go back to the time when you were working as a model and you were flying around the world, but for a different reason. You're working as a model. Tell me the story from high-flying model to high-flying lawyer.
Okay. Well, so I was traveling internationally. I was represented by Ford Models and a number of other agents internationally as well, and sort of our mother agent type scenario, and had to deal with the guy with the badge and the gun on many occasions at the border, going through to get various work permits, and really realized this is quite absolutely profound in order for me to get the job done, and had many countless conversations with my agents about, the trials and tribulations of that part of the process of getting the work done. And so it really, the idea sort of sprouted from that. And I had done a lot of work in the US, and then immigrated and started going to law school after model. I was always doing schooling actually during modeling. I always wanted to be an advocate, and I just wasn't sure what exactly I was going to tap into necessarily, but the international aspect came very natural. So went to LA, did law school, and a lot of my friends and contacts from the industry started reaching out to me and needed assistance with this application or that scenario they had at the consulate or whatnot. And so it snowballed into a good set of wonderful clients that I was serving. And I guess the good word got around that we were doing so well with our petitions and serving our clients. And so just sort of kept growing from there. And I think that the team is vitally important. I think that, I would be absolutely nothing without my team. I cannot be in all places at once. You need to cover different time zones. You need to be checked in locally, I want to say, to the different posts that you are, and you want to be able to collaborate and brainstorm and strategize with your team, because there's all kinds of last minute surprises that come up in the immigration community that I don't care who you are. It's very difficult to predict that. I think there's really only one lawyer I know that's been amazing at predicting these things, and it's Ira Kurzban, but who's been around for a long, long time, a bit of a legend in the field, but it's very difficult even for all of us. So you want to be able to, have that personal touch in terms of, like, we've been through it ourselves, many of us being, you know, former artists and former, I mean, I don't know if you ever stop being an artist, and maybe it's probably still always still in your blood there, but, you know, and, you know, from the good work, the awards came, the recognition came, Century City and many, many publications. I love to write, and I love to, you know, be a voice in the community and be in touch with my community, and in terms of, you know, a helpful and appropriate commentary that is, you know, useful right now, that's for sure. So I would say it grew from, you know, a personal experience of having worked in these industries, and then it's the good work and I guess word of mouth type thing. So
your first 50 clients, were they all other models trying to, you know, was it as simple as that, or is that an exaggeration?
It was models and casting directors and a lot in the entertainment field. And then it started to spread to more people behind the scenes and in business. And, you know, entertainment is quite locked in now with digital and tech. So then it started sprouting to tech and digital. And so the main industries we're serving are entertainment, digital and tech. And I would say actually during COVID, well, prior to COVID, but even during COVID, I'm working with a lot of people in sports and e-gaming as well.
Because particularly there's an education part to this, in the sense that maybe it's less so now, but at the beginning of this, sort of people's IMDb printouts being part of their exceptional talent process, box office receipts. And as things move forward into things like e-gaming and sports, you know, I mean, most people, e-sports is one of those things where you either understand it completely and think it's incredible and you'll know that it's the third biggest sport in America behind the NFL and NBA, or you think it's just, you know, kids in the basement playing computer games. But is there an element where these immigration officers, you have to sort of educate them that somebody with, you know, 4 million followers on YouTube and however many on Twitch, like that makes them exceptionally talented in a visa sense? So is there an educational element to the people filing the applications?
Absolutely. You need to spend a lot of time actually to educate them on the field. Some of them have a background, others do not. And I would definitely, from the e-gaming side, there it can be enormous knowledge gaps there. However, the good news is I have actually experienced that those cases tend to go through quite quickly. And if you get the right officer, can really engage with the documentation that you've submitted and understands the type of exposure and commercial success that is just like off the charts, that these, especially the young gamers and also the software developers that are coming in to, you know, adjust these games and make them so engaging to like a whole hologramic virtual reality, I want to say. So yeah, I definitely, we have to spend a lot of time really, you know, putting out the numbers there and defining who the audience is and why this matters to America. And yeah, so and the numbers are quite staggering, I have to say. Contracts there, I don't think many people in e-gaming are really suffering during COVID right now.
No, I guess so. This is maybe a difficult question, but I want to ask it. So obviously I know how good you are as a lawyer because you got me in, so you must be very good. But also, as I say, you've helped out people I know. Particularly when you were starting, being a former model turned lawyer, although that gives you a massive advantage in the sense that you've got a client base, you understand it. Was there any, and obviously going back, you know, 10, 15 years, views were maybe different from what they are today. Was there a sort of, you're a former model, not a proper lawyer? Was there any sexism or people disparaging what you were trying to do because you actually were a model before?
Yeah, I would say yes, I agree with that. I think there's definitely been a few awkward meetings that I've had where you're a lawyer, you know, the modeling, you know, was something that you kind of sprouted from and grew from, but it's, and I think that the professionalism in some of these meetings was not what it should be. And maybe it's a little bit of biases that can come into that conversation about, you know, what what you may, you know, may have encountered in the modeling industry. It's like, I mean, I was really hardworking. I'm a super A drive person. So my modeling career was very much means to an end. And, you know, and I enjoyed very much, you know, learning about the brands that I was working with and treated it very much as absolutely a business. And I do represent supermodels and, you know, top people in fashion. I actually just did a speaking event for New Women's Org for their fashion division, and was speaking to on the panel with Glaudy, who is just like one of the superstars right now for Beverly Hills in fashion, and you know, dressing all the couture for celebrities. And I think that, you know, these people get it. They get her story. Even that designer story is fascinating, and what they came from and how they got there, but some don't. And it hits a sensitive, I mean, I have been in some very awkward situations, I will say. So I don't know if they're even worth repeating, but it's just, I think you just gotta, you know, rise above it and move on. And oh well.
Got better now, or is it still, there's still remnants of that old world that you encounter?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I even had some recent experiences. I think that women, you know, that have been in the modeling field, and, you know, maybe there's like this fear that your success in business should not be tied to your feminist appearance or feminist aesthetics. And somehow we need to become more masculine. And I've never really been that way. And I don't think I could try, but I think I'd probably fail miserably and look really awkward. And so I think that, you know, your prowess and your ambition and your success as a female in business can be absolutely tied to also your demonstration and exhibiting of your feminine appearance, and that's okay. And I think that is totally fine. I mean, of course, there's a line in terms of professionalism and then non-professional, you know, dress and look and appearance and that sort of thing, or even image and what you're putting out there in terms of your image and that message you're sending to the community. I think I sit on in that camp of, you know, in terms of the gender argument there, and you know, with those groups of feminists. So but unfortunately, I have had some not great experiences even as of late. So I don't think it's died down, but at the same time, you know, you just sort of have, I think that's why you have to have a great sense of humor, right? And drink lots of whiskey.
Yeah, well, no, indeed. I don't disagree with that. So look, you know, you've got an international immigration firm. Everything's, you know, it's never been busier. When will things go back to normal, do you think? Either in terms of, because you've got the double whammy, as it were, of COVID plus what's happened with immigration policy. Presumably, you know, after January the 20th, that will solve some of those issues, but then COVID will still be one. When do you see your world going back to what you remember it being sort of pre-2016?
Oh, so true. Oh my goodness. We have earned our grays, haven't we? it will start, as I mentioned, January 20th, but I do think that it will be many, many months until we start to see some of the remnants coming back, probably into the spring, summer, even fall. So it's just really going to be this whole year that we'll start to see that changeover happening. And I would say it's months, not years. It's not going to be days. A lot of people think come January 20th, everything's going to be back to normal. No, it's going to take quite a bit of time. And the mindset, really, it's the mindset of the officers, you know, getting used to the new supervisors and new policies that are being put in place now, and the repealing, and oh, right, we're not following that doctrine anymore, we're doing this. And, you know, a lot of these folks, they're operating with checklists and sitting there with these applications and deciding people's future in about 15 to 20 minutes. So that's a lot of power right there. And, you know, getting that mindset in the right place is going to take, unfortunately, a little bit of time. But I think that in terms of the consulates and the backlog, we will start to be seeing that as well in the new year and getting through that backlog.
But obviously, I know how busy you are and how many people are probably waiting for you. So I'll end with our last question, which is, if you could drink any whiskey with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be, what would it be, and where would it be?
So I would probably, you know, maybe I would do Jefferson's 17-year-old presidential select, maybe just because we're doing the whole U.S. thing here. But perhaps, just to make the bridge with the UK here, I'd if I could have anything, and even the after people that have since gone could come back, I'd probably share that whiskey with my grandfather, who's from Manchester, and I'd probably, you know, sit with him in perhaps his old neighborhood in Manchester and have a drink with him. And he did a lot of work for the unions. He was a union activist. he was a hard worker and it was an advocate in his own right. And so I would love to do that. How about yourself?
So actually, interestingly, this is the 52nd episode of the podcast. On the 50th, I was asked for the first time, and my answer was also my grandfather. So my grandfather, who I never met because he died when my father was young in South Africa. So but I would also go the grandfather route. So very good. But Lorraine, thank you for your time today. It's fascinating hearing what it's like at the coalface of immigration law during the busiest and most complicated period. I'm glad I got mine before all this started.
I know. You are lucky.
I was lucky. So,
Well, the approvals are still coming through, but it's just we have to work hard. We have to work very hard. So they are coming through. It hasn't been all, you know, tears. It certainly hasn't. But I'm so glad you are in good position, and you are here to tell the tale.
And what you said about, you know, sort of advocating for people, you know, it's such a big thing, because for us, you know, we moved to America with work, and then when we decided I wanted to change career and we didn't want to leave here because the family were settled, you know, we went through this process, and if it hadn't worked, we would have had to go, I guess, back to England or maybe to another country. You know, and our daughter was born here, so she's got an American passport. Our kids were going to be taken out of school. There's so much around it. You know, it's not just stamping bits of paper. You know, these, as you say, these people have got incredible power. And I remember when we went into the office for our interview, and, you know, the guy had a pile of papers, and it was incredible because you think everything would be digital, but they've got physical files, and they were just up against the wall. And I remember thinking, there are literally hundreds of families whose futures are being decided. And, you know, what happens if they lose one of those files? And some, I mean, you know, I think we had a delay of a few months because our son got separated, and, you know, the irony that they were physically separating children at the border, we got digitally separated from our 8-year-old son as part of this process.
That's right. And,
you know, just, you know, a pen stroke one way or another decides the fate of a family and their future. It's, as someone who's been through this process, and we were, you know, nowhere near probably the desperation or economic peril of other people are doing this. There's so much in it. So, you know, you're obviously, you know, you're doing a great job, but, you know, you are genuinely changing lives, and we're grateful for it. And I'm sure all of those people you're fighting for now are as well. Lorraine D'Alessio of D'Alessio Law Group, thank you very much. Cheers. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me. A joy and a pleasure. All right. Bye-bye.
I love scotch. 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 Yep.
And don't forget to not just follow us on Twitter and Instagram at US of Dramerica, but also ask us questions and comment and say nice things.
And please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if the mood takes you, you can leave us a review, as feedback is always welcome.
And drink whiskey. Sláinte.